Thank you, all of you, for coming out, and I want to thank and acknowledge the folks in Orange who've come down quite a distance today. John, as you know, comes from the very top of the state, and he, to my knowledge, along with Susan, from Franconia Sugar Hill, I don't think they've missed a single event anywhere because they're so passionately involved in this. And I heard John say in Holderness one night, sure, John in Holderness one night said, if something like this is going on, you don't need to invite me. I'm just going to be there. And I think that's really the spirit in which they operate. And there is a lot of passion surrounding this. To the points just made by you, sir, a moment ago, I've been saying of late, recalling that 40 or 50 years ago, everyone here in the East Coast thought it was a great idea to import cheap foreign oil. Onassis wanted to build a refinery down on the seacoast. If you were from New Hampshire and remember those days, it was defeated because people didn't want to see a refinery in Durham, of all places. But the incentive behind that was a good business deal where you could import cheap product, refine it, and sell it. Today, we understand that the importation of cheap foreign oil is not a great idea, that it has created a dependency, if not an addiction. And we ship out 80% of every dollar we spend here in New Hampshire to foreign sources of the supply of oil. I think the figure for the entire state is over $1 billion. And it's millions of dollars just in Cowas County. And if you think about what benefit money can do if kept at home, it being so hard to attract capital in some parts of the state, what a brilliant idea it would be to find policies that encourage the development of alternative sources and practice conservation so that we can do things to adequately utilize limited resources like our forest, like our wind, like other things, solar, so that we can employ people, have local control of and local ownership of business opportunities. And in fact, I'm going to jump through too many hoops at the same time, but one of the organizations that's come out in opposition to this is the North Country Council, which is the regional planning commission for the northern county of Cowas and the northern portions of Grafton and Carroll. You have your own regional planning commission down here, and we do a lot of cooperating back and forth. They came out against this because the comprehensive economic development strategy that they develop for the EDA in the Department of Commerce specifically addresses energy as one of the things that can help the northern part of the state through the very severe economic transformation or transition that it's going through right now. And we had a paper economy in essence, where we utilized the forest, employed hundreds of people, and we shipped capital from outside the region into the North Country where it did its work. And people were employed and gainfully employed, well employed. We have lost that. And we do not have very many contributors to that tradable sector of our economy, the two sectors being the tradable sector that brings in capital and the sheltered sector where we all do each other's laundry. Well, you can't have an economy that lasts if we're only doing each other's laundry. We have to import capital. That's why tourism is so fundamentally important. That's why our forest industries remain so fundamentally important, and why we need to focus our policies and our developments on things that will utilize those resources, employ people, and help the economy of our state. If we have something like this, as would be the case with more dependence on foreign oil, as you simply pointed out very simply a moment ago, we'll add to that export of dollars. We will not create opportunity here, and we will not be practicing conservation. And in fact, that's what's happening in Canada. The Gazette article that Will just referred to was really an interesting one, and I think maybe you could sign up or something if you want to get a link for some of these things or be on the list for information that's being sent out by the folks up north that have come together to talk about this. And boy, if the internet hasn't proven its value so far, it's proved it on this thing. But if I can keep my trains of thought, because they're going through about 14 different stations at once here, the Quebec article talked about the horrible impact that this entire thing is having and has had on the province, and the fact that they are sometimes shortchanging their own people in order to gain profits. They're increasing the number of dams, the amount of reservoirs, and the destruction of the landscape. in order to increase the inflow of that capital, which they also need and want. And they're doing it at the exclusion of other alternative schemes that environmentalists and others are urging them to please consider, because they have tremendous capacity for wind power and tremendous capacity for solar power. And in fact, their wind power could easily take care of the projected new generation of power in Canada to meet their own needs. But this hungry provincial practice of damming rivers, eliminating entire forest areas and creating dry riverbeds on the other side of dams that are backing up reservoirs, that's what they're addicted to up there, because it's the business plan, it's the long-term strategy, and it's working. But they're not doing things that would make more sense. And I'll quote from that article, and I'm way out of my own schedule of discussion here, but in this they talk, at this stage, they've definitely proven that saving electricity is cheaper than producing it. And they say that experts note that Quebec could save three times the amount of energy that will be produced by the Romaine project, which is the damming of the Romaine River, only one of the many that have been destroyed as a result of their activity there. And it was the subject of this article because someone had taken a trip down the river a couple of years before they did the project, and now they're talking about the devastation that's happened in its place. But they could save three times the amount of energy that would produce by this project just by insulating homes and installing proper windows that meet the latest standards. The cost of this would be three times cheaper than building the Romaine River Dam. So you have the question, somebody wants to spend $1 billion. What if you spent it on conservation and the creation of alternative energy systems here in New Hampshire, without the kind of destruction and risks that we're exposing ourselves to here? There's a lot of passion surrounding this issue, and it's really a question, and I thank all of you, because so far at least, your towns may not, I don't know where you're all from, but your towns may not be directly impacted by a line coming across your front lawn. So the fact that you're here and concerned about this is a wonderful compliment to you, and we are very grateful for that. And we just hope that you can sort of get other people informed, if not agitated, because this really is a significant issue for all of New Hampshire. It's just that we don't wake up to it like Deerfield did the other day until you suddenly find it on your front door. But it's all in our yard. And I think of those examples, whether they be biblical or otherwise, that talk about the fact that if you lose a member, the whole body suffers. If one part of your community goes down, the entire community goes down. If one part of the state suffers, then in some way the entire state suffers. So we are all partners in this, and it's going to impact all of us. And I'll get into my view of some of the larger economic issues in a moment. But it is a question, in order to be objective about this, and because people talk about it being the not in my backyard group, but it's so far beyond that. When I started this, I was concerned about towers, and I was concerned about my neighbors and my friends and my clients and my customers, because I'm in the real estate business and have been for 37 years up there, concerned about the impact. 30 years ago in the early 80s, I was involved in fighting the one that got sent to Vermont and now comes down through Cumberford and goes down through the rest of the state. The Site Evaluation Committee, or its equivalent then, did not permit it, so they went through Vermont. My understanding, the reason that they don't want to go through Vermont now is that they're simply afraid that that regulatory process over there may be more difficult than New Hampshire's. So that's not a terribly great compliment to us, perhaps, but I think we'd like to prove them wrong, because I think that people have a voice in this. The question is how we can exercise it and who's going to listen. But if you begin to look at the benefits versus the cost, we all started worrying about towers. But it goes way beyond that, and as you dig deeper, peel back the layers of the onion, you find that these issues are fundamental to our economy and our place, and that the only option for me is the no-build option. And I think that's the only one that's ultimately going to make any sense. And I know from negotiations, because I've been doing it for 37 years, if you get someone talking to you about the details, you know you're halfway home, because they've already made the decision to sell or buy. And the question is, what are the terms going to be? So if we begin talking, in my view, about give us an alternative, which is what they're doing right now, they just showed up at the selectman's office in Dummer north of Berlin on the other side of the state saying, well, how would you guys feel about it over here? We're looking for alternatives. And that can happen right here in Hanover and Lubbock in this area if other locations are gone. So the question becomes for them, which of you is willing to throw the other under the bus like we did to Vermont 30 years ago? I'm not sure that's a good policy when you take into account the larger issues that are involved here. I'm not sure that it's good practice to throw someone else under the bus if inherently and fundamentally the idea is simply no good for our state or our country. And if you, when we get in, and I may cover some of the same ground but in a slightly different way, when you get into the cost of this thing, I'm gonna just back up for just a second. And I wanted to, poor Bob is down here from Columbia, which is just short of Colebrook, which is just short of Pittsburgh. And I want to be limited on my time because I could go on. Well, that's a long time to ask everybody to wait. And Bob has a lot to say as well about eminent domain and some other issues, whatever he intends to cover. So I don't want to be here for more than 15 or 20 minutes or something. Yeah, just kick me. Even though everybody wants to hear what I have to say. Sure. Okay. Okay. All right. I'm a short one compared to Will. I don't know if we can move this up. I'll try my best, but if I'm not doing this correctly, just raise a hand and I'll try to do better. I want to run through some issues and do it quickly because, again, it's the trade-off of benefits and risks and real sacrifice that many parts of the state would be suffering. First of all, Will did a great job of talking about the origin of the project and the long-term strategy that's involved. One of the things we as a community must begin to do is to demand of our political leadership and those in the regulatory process the development of an energy policy. We don't have one at the state level, we don't have one at the federal level that can guide us through these circumstances. It's basically a foot race. We know that neither ISO, New England, nor the PUC has said we need the power. ISO has said it's not essential for the reliability of the system, yet we're having to contend with it. And the possibility is that we could have it rammed down our throat whether or not there's any community benefit. This particularly becomes onerous when you start talking about things like eminent domain. And I remember Elmer Black up in Whitefield, who lost 300 acres to the regional high school. And when he was still alive, he spent 30 years complaining about it, but saying at the end, well, at least the kids are there. At least the community got something. Imagine losing your property or the value of your property without the benefit of knowing that somebody got something out of it. Because as we'll see, there simply are not benefits that justify this project accruing to the people of New Hampshire. And the subject of rates, Jim Dennis from Dalton, who's semi-retired, an attorney and a fellow who was involved with hedge funds. I hear an echo. Is this hard to hear? Is it working? Okay. He did a lot with utility financing. And he has taken all of the data that's published and printed, given out by Northern Pass, Public Service, PUC, and all the federal agencies. And he's done an analysis, which I actually have a copy of and which I could send to people or Jim could send to people who are interested, that looks at the wholesale rates, the amount of energy that would be produced and consumed, the factors that Will talked about, you know, how energy is priced on a daily basis when it goes out for sale. And he has determined that the maximum benefit, after a great deal of calculation and review of all these mounds of material, the absolute maximum benefit would be 1% savings on the average bill for the average consumer here in New Hampshire. The average bill is just under $97 a month. The savings would be about 97 cents a month. But that's only if all the right things happen relative to the wholesale price for power when demand goes back up with an enriched economy, because right now it's down and it would be less. And only if the PUC decides to award those revenues to the consumer and not have them retained by public service company, because public service company is not in good shape. They're owned by Northeast Utilities. They're a distribution company that also owns generation capacity. They want to get involved with Laidlaw and Berlin, which I could spend another hour on but won't, relative to the wise use of our limited resources. But the likelihood in Jim's analysis is that PUC will not allow those funds to be transferred to the consumer because they're needed so desperately by the company. So the probable impact could be closer to zero when it comes to rates. Now, curiously, I'm on the board of the New Hampshire Timberland Owners Association, which is comprised of people who own land, loggers, mill operators, and others associated with that industry, foresters, and people who care, like the Forest Society does, about the forest. They practice conservation. They're concerned more from a business side than perhaps the Forest Society in some things, but they are still slugging for the same thing, and that's the retention of this important resource we have, which is fundamental to our economy for many parts of the state and therefore the entire state. But they made an hour presentation, Northern Pass did, to the board and members of the policy committee, and they threw out rather casually, well, you know, one of the things is we may save $25-30 million in rates, you know, costs lowered down, and which later, incidentally, I noticed in the paper that the more precise thing they're comfortable in saying is $23 million. So she was a little cavalier in throwing out her numbers. And I raised my hand and I said, well, there were three of them there. I said, well, that's the nominator. What's the denominator? $23 million or $25 million out of how much? And they looked at each other, and I explained my question further, and they finally answered it by turning to Pat McDermott and saying, and he said, about $1.5 billion. So if you take the 25 over $1.5 billion, it works out to 1.5%. Now, I don't know what the real number is for $1.5 billion. I suspect that if they did their own honest calculation, they'd have to tell you that Jim Danis was right on target. But if he was off 0.5%, forgive me, there's another 45 cents. But the impact on rates is going to be minimal, if anything. So let's erase that, even though we hear them talk about it all the time. Need, Will has addressed, and I've already mentioned it. We don't have a need regionally or statewide. We don't have a policy that tells us how to evaluate these things, and I really feel that in the North Country, because you keep hearing about these different projects coming from different places, and what is the impact on the region, the state, this part of the Northeast, who knows? But the value question, which I guess is what people think I should be most informed about, but I get really passionate about all the rest of this stuff. The value, there's simply no question about the impact of this project on value. You were talking about the height of the tower. Well, the State House, if you're accustomed to going down Route 93 and you look over at the building, the State House is about 148 feet tall, I'm told, if you look to the top of the Eagle. So you can drop down 10 to 12 feet, and that's where you'll be for the top of this tower. And although the tower is not as wide as the State House, and it's not made for us in gold, maybe for someone it will be gold, you can imagine them spread all along that 93 corridor and what it would look like. You cannot place ugly objects, I'm not saying the State House is ugly, but these towers certainly are, on a beautiful landscape without affecting marketability and value. If you look, it's intuitive. I feel like, why should I have to explain that to anybody? How can Northern Pass say that it won't be that way? If you go to a residential subdivision, and even out in the middle of nowhere, when I built my home back in 1973 and '4, people bury the line between the street and their home. It's just a little line. Why do they do that? Because it's ugly. Because they will enjoy where they are more without it. Because when they have a view, it won't interrupt it. And when they sell it, they know it will have a better protected value. Of recent decades, that's been a common practice when people searched for quality and could afford it. So if you can always sell something that lacks quality, that has been degraded, as long as you can lower your price to the point where the market will respond.
That's inherent and fundamental. You will experience a loss of value if you look out upon, from areas like ours, a landscape that has been changed negatively by the appearance of these 135-foot or 90-foot or 120-foot towers, whatever they may be. If you look to the impact that their projects have had in Quebec and the sea of towers that are coming from their projects down to southern Quebec to come into the United States, you can tell they pretty much don't give a damn what is going to happen to New Hampshire, because they haven't cared about what's happening in Quebec. They had I've reviewed a number of studies from all over the country. They're all of urban and suburban locations. They all involve areas where there's already been a degradation of some sort in the environment. There's traffic, there's noise, there's congestion, there's other commercial development. And the rate of loss varies from one location to another depending upon where they're starting with their, what I'll call their aesthetic baseline. So in a city area or in the state of Wisconsin, where Will sent me comments that someone made on a study up there, you may have a loss of 20% in a subdivision that's looking out on a power line compared to those lots that don't look out on a power line, but then you read along and you find out they all look out on a rail line and they all look out on an industrial park. But even with that, I mean, those things would hurt our values up here, but even with that, there's still a loss if they're looking out on a power line. And basically, an above-ground high-voltage line is a form of environmental degradation as defined in so many studies, and a classic case of economic depreciation. There are studies that quantify or attempt to quantify what happens when you have environmental degradation, what happens to values. They drop, and they classify above-ground transmission lines right along with feedlots and hazardous waste sites and nuclear power plants. So if you have these things in your view or in your area, they are going to affect your value. People are already voting with their feet, practicing what you call prudent avoidance by not purchasing properties that could be affected by this line all up and down the proposed primary corridor and alternative corridors, because they don't want to put their equity, their resources at risk. And whenever someone is asked to risk what they have, including good health, they will not invest in that thing if they don't have to. And the health issue is complicated. I'm not an expert either. This article in the Gazette talked about a study that had been done in connection with Hydro-Quebec's work, which they suppressed, that pointed out a connection not to leukemia, which was the subject of the study, because that could not be proven statistically, but a high incidence of lung cancer. And the basic conclusion was that when you have pulsing electromagnetic fields of some sort, then you're going to have a higher incidence of cancer. Well, I don't know what the answer to that is. Maybe yes, maybe no. But the simple fact that people worry about it will cause them not to purchase property. And in the state of New York, they had a case that said that the mere existence of the fear of that impact is cause for compensation in a suit, so that even if it's not rational or reasonable, the simple fact of its existence being prevalent becomes a cause for compensation. So my children and my family would not be located next to a line like this if I thought for 2 seconds that they could be harmed, nor would most reasonable people. Jim Danis, again, the fellow who did this work on rates, has hired, because he has some very beautiful property and a fair amount of it in Dalton, has hired an appraiser to do a before and after analysis of his land. And he took one segment of it and said, okay, here's a 135-acre parcel. Within that, we have land on either side of a proposed corridor, which is exactly where they want to send it. So let's look at, for a certain depth, let's look at the impact on 32 acres. And then he had a 12-acre site that his son actually was to build on, where the line goes right through it. And he hired and put the appraiser through a very detailed and paid, I'm sure, I don't know what he paid, but I'm sure he paid a lot to get it done. They did a very detailed analysis, the short form of which is only a few dozen pages, but the long form is hundreds. They substantiated a loss, depending upon the size of the parcel and the proximity to the line and what you saw, of between 63 and 91% in value just for land. Now, if you had improved property on that property, if you had a home or something that you created and invested in as for value, you would have a reduction that would be similar in percent, but larger in dollars, depending upon how it was impacted. But if you have anything that is encroached by this property, the one thing that all of these studies in Los Angeles, in Bouchard, Canada, there are dozens of them, all again in suburban and urban areas, the one thing they have in common is that values are lowered. Now, in the North Country and in places along this valley and other places that are of real beauty here in New Hampshire, the degree of loss and change is going to be higher, because in places like that, you start with a higher aesthetic baseline. You don't have the rail line, you don't have the industrial park, you don't have the congestion, the noise, the traffic, the highway, and everything else. You have beautiful, clear, clean, unobstructed views. And when you go in and make a change to that, what might be 5, 10, 20, 25% someplace else in the middle of the city turns out to be 60 to 90% in a location like ours, or if in fact you have a power line going through it, you may not be able to sell it at all, except to the fellow who's desperate, who wants to put a trailer somewhere, who doesn't give a damn about his health, and who you're willing to take back a note from. And if that's the case on a 12-acre lot, and you want to do it for a dollar down and a few bucks a month, you might get $3,000 or $4,000 out of it. But otherwise, who in the world would buy a 12-acre lot with a power line down through the middle and build a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar home and make some other improvement of even $100,000, which you can't build much for $100,000 no matter where you are. So that seems so clear to me that I'm not going to go into the weeds of all these studies. I can just tell you that the one thing, including Northern Pass's own study, where they hired a guy from Arizona and a guy from California to look at 38 studies done by people in Massachusetts and Connecticut of areas like Bloomfield and Stoughton and places I don't know that much about, but I did go to Google, and I flew over them at 10,000 and 20,000 and 30,000 feet. They didn't look a lot like northern New Hampshire or any other part of New Hampshire, except maybe Nashua and Manchester. So, like politics, all assessment is local. And you simply cannot, in areas of great beauty, reduce the quality without reducing the value. Now, what about tax rates? They say that they're going to put the line through and it will improve the tax revenue for many towns, and indeed, it would add tax revenue initially to many towns. But as the record develops and you have these losses in value as a result of it, you are first of all going to find people already now trying to get abatements to lower their tax bill because of the loss. Secondly, you are going to suffer, as we do in Lancaster and many other places, from having a line item in your budget every year to fight abatements by the utilities, because they will claim depreciation for physical loss of depreciation, or maybe their companies like TransCanada argued successfully in court against the town of Littleton recently that because they had sold less power, the company was worth less, and therefore all of their assets were worth less. And right now, the town of Littleton is reimbursing TransCanada for $6.1 million. It's a heck of an impact on a small town, but that's what they're doing right now to try to contend with that case. In Lancaster, it's a common thing. You know, our lines aren't worth what they were. Your assessment's too high, so let's knock that down. Finally, the third way in which the idea of benefit from taxation might exist is that you will not see improvements occur where these lands that I've discussed have been impacted. Two houses in Lancaster. You wouldn't think people were doing this way up north. But there are two homes in Lancaster that were recently constructed that right now, one of them only partway through, one right now equal $2.5 million in assessed value on the town's books, equal to one mile of power line. Neither of those homes would have been built. They are not being occupied by people who are adding to the burdens of the community in education or anything else. They are being occupied by people who have long-standing relationships with the town and love it. They buy groceries in our grocery store. They buy pharmaceutical items in the drug store. They buy clothes in the clothing store. They join our boards. They attend our meetings. They continue to put money into the economy, not just for the construction of the home, but maintenance and care of it. That's an ongoing benefit that power lines can't do, won't do, and can't be expected to do. They won't attend our meetings, join our boards, or buy groceries in our stores. So the difference is pretty clear as to what's going to accrue to the most benefit to our community. We cannot suffer the loss, nor can we measure the loss, nor will we be compensated for the loss that we would experience by the construction of these things and the projects that won't happen that might otherwise happen, subject to whatever local rules and regulations you have, none of which apply, incidentally, to the power line. No planning board will ever hear a word about this. So I think the idea of getting a great benefit from property taxes is, again, of no real value to us and not a reason why we should sacrifice what we are potentially sacrificing in order to get the power line or whatever tax revenue would come from it. Supply-demand, we've alluded to this already. If you increase the supply of power and it is looked upon as being less expensive and it's in super-adequate supply, you will not be developing alternative energies, you will not be practicing conservation. But beyond that, public service right now is putting the wood to alternative energy sources. They're refusing to negotiate new purchase power agreements with four of the biomass plants existing in New Hampshire right now. Billy Allen has a little 640 kilowatt plant up in Groveton. They used to pay him wholesale power rates at 9%. They're now paying him 3.1. They don't want his power. They're not interested in that kind of power. They want to do a sweetheart deal with Laidlaw and buy power from the company in which they will ultimately have an interest for more than what the existing biomass plants are willing to charge them even today. Why is that important? That's important because biomass is the tail end of a timber harvest. I want to bring you back to the idea that our forest industry is horrendously important to everyone in New Hampshire, whether or not you know it, because the northern part of the state, of which this tonight, unusually, I will say, is a part of the northern part of New Hampshire, even for us chauvinists way up north, we are all in that rural area. And we like open space. We like what Tom Thompson and other people do to keep their land together so that it can be beautiful for our tourism, for our own pleasure, for the quality of life. If you do not provide economic reason and incentive for people to keep their lands together, they won't. Higher and better uses will press upon them, and ultimately it will go. The Main Street program, which is a daughter or son of the Preservation Alliance or Society or something, the national thing. They started this because they know that the only way to preserve buildings is not to buy them and stick them on the shelf. The only way to preserve buildings is to revitalize a main street so the main street becomes economically viable and people can put old buildings to good use and therefore keep them. But if you just try to preserve it with no money coming in, you don't have enough money to buy every building to keep it alive. And the same is true of the forest. The forest requires good utilization from a strong industry in order to manage it. And if it's not managed, it won't be healthy. So if you don't have an industry using the forest, you won't have a healthy forest. If you don't have a healthy forest, you won't have good industry to provide jobs and help people. But the big bottom line is you won't have the forest because you won't have the economy to support it. That's where we all have the same buy-in here, and why a biomass plant is important, because they pick up the final end of an otherwise much more productive harvest. A load of chips going down the road from my own property, I was told by my forester, he said, "What do you think that load of chips is going to give you?" And I said, "I have no idea. What's it worth?" And he said, "That's going to give you $45, a big truckload full of chips." There's no way in the world I'm going to commit my forest just for chips. It's the byproduct of something else that has to happen to bring the real value of the forest to the landowner and keep that whole thing in place. But if you take away the chips, suddenly you've pulled one of the legs of the stool out from underneath the body and it collapses. We need that tail end to help the landowner and the logger and everybody else who's employed and benefits from the process as this goes down the food chain. We need that as a vital source of fiber. And what about fiber? Skipping a bit now to the Quebec situation and this whole thing, it makes me just ill to see all this stuff. Okay, I got a hand going up. I'm going to do 3 minutes on the hallelujah windup on the green issue. 7 million acres inundated. Conservatively, 5 million acres of forest, clear cut or drowned. Eliminating from the regional economy, of which, you know, the trees and the birds and the bees don't care where the political subdivisions are. They cross them all the time. So does our economy cross them all the time. So you've got 5 million acres at least taken out of timber production, inundated, and no longer acting like a dialysis machine for the environment. A forester in Rumney, Bob Birdie, has calculated that, or shared with me at least and us, that it takes 1.47 pounds of carbon to grow a pound of wood. An acre of growing forest adds 4,000 pounds of fiber a year. In 1 acre, therefore, you have 3.1 tons of carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere and 4,200 pounds of oxygen put back into the environment. When you eliminate 5 million acres of photosynthesis, you eliminate the sequestration of 15 million tons of carbon, and you fail to release back into the environment 10 million pounds of oxygen. This is like the loss of the rainforest. It's why scientists in both the United States and in Canada are saying, please, Canada, stop ruining your forest, stop allowing them to go to other uses. The boreal forests of Canada are one of the largest resources existing and remaining in the world for the retention of water and the photosynthesis that it does for our environment. Please keep it. But in the face of that, in Quebec, the powers in Quebec are simply continuing to eliminate more and more of it. At the same time, as has been suggested, you have inordinate releases of methane because of the rotting vegetation under the surface of that water. And I'm told that two gentlemen in Dartmouth have done a paper on what's happening with the mixture of water in those rivers, in the bedrock in that particular area, that it's releasing high quantities of ethyl mercury, killing fish, and dumping into the James Bay. So it's not green, no matter how you measure it. And I guess I, like everybody else, could go on for another 40, but I'm done.